Today, we interview Adam Larson of Cottonwood Communities about multifamily real estate.
This is Jerry Tuma Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Tuma. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.
The following is an interview with Adam Larson of Cottonwood Communities. Jerry and Adam will discuss where multifamily real estate is today and its outlook. All right, so let's go to our interview with Adam Larson of Cottonwood Communities. But before we do that, I do need to mention a little disclaimer that this is neither an offer to sell nor a solicitation of an offer to buy securities. An offer to sell any securities in Cottonwood Communities may only be made pursuant to a confidential private placement memorandum or prospectus as amended and supplemented. All right, Jerry, again, our focus is more the macro overview of his industry, not his specific products. So I'll let you go ahead and start the interview with Adam Larson.
Absolutely. We got Adam Larson. He's the Chief Financial Officer of Cottonwood Communities, folks we've known for well over a decade. And I'll just put it this way, my favorite guys in the apartment field, and apartments have been a long time. I remember interviewing one guy a long time back, several years ago, and he was taking some profits on apartments and moving to other sectors. This was a different type of real estate structure where they could go across different sectors. And he said, well, if I had to pick one sector of the marketplace forever, it would be apartments. So I'm not saying that's a guarantee. Obviously, it's clearly not. But we want to talk in more detail about what's going on with the apartment communities and what's going on with apartments, because you're getting all sorts of media backlash about, and there's truth to it, but is it overboard? You know, I think it is. I think there's a lot of things that are causing more angst about the apartment investment arena than it is necessary, really. So what we want to do is dive into this in a deep dive with Adam Larson, Chief Financial Officer of Cottonwood Communities. Let me start with my first question here. Now, we all know that real estate's been correcting, and we've had a down market since the Fed went on what was essentially the most aggressive rate hike cycle we've seen in 40 years. Now, most real estate types are down across the board. I'm showing apartments down about 30% from their highs as recently as the end of 2003. That's according to Green Street Commercial Property Index. Two primary factors seem to be at work here, and I'd like you to comment on this. First would be the pending oversupply. It happens in every cycle and every industry. When you get to the top of a cycle, people overbuild, overborrow, overleverage, or whatever. So first of all, we're going to have a pending oversupply. Best estimate, there could be as much as 1 million new multifamily units under construction in 2024. That's the highest since the 1970s. Bank Credit Analyst, May 2024. Secondly is the decline in the, quote, cap rates. And I want you to explain cap rates. The cap rates for real estate have been declining due to assumptions about future values. And I know, folks, we're getting very technical here, but I think you're going to understand this as this goes, and I think it's going to be a great interview. The cap rates for real estate are based on assumptions of future values on the real estate with this large run up in interest rates. All right, so two questions from that. I know this is a run-on question here. Number one, my sense is that we're probably at or near the bottom as interest rates appear to have peaked out for this cycle. I think that's becoming more apparent by the day. Number one, do you agree? And number two on that one, how do you think this could potentially affect property values? That's the first question. Question number two, apartment completions are the highest in over 40 years right now. We're seeing enormous demand, though, from millennials and Gen Zs moving into family formation. 127 million Americans, according to PwC, are estimated we have a housing shortage right now of 3.9 million housing units. So on the one hand, we have overbuilding in the short run. On the other hand, it appears we have a long-term shortage and a population boom. Would you please tell us what your perspective is?
Absolutely. And thank you for having me, by the way. I think it's helpful to jump back and provide a little bit of context into the, you know, just overall housing across the United States. And I'll go back to the great financial crisis when, as you mentioned, Jerry, in your question, right before the great financial crisis, we were at a peak of supply deliveries for all types of housing, single family, multifamily, and candidly, probably over delivering more than the demand that was available for housing, given some of the aggressive risk taking in the housing sector. You entered into the great financial crisis and bank regulators brought the hammer down on banks, inserted new regulations that effectively required banks to reserve higher capital against those loans that they were making in all types of real estate. You had a lot of developers going out of business. You had lending standards were increased and enhanced. No longer could you borrow without income verification. Down payments were increased, and effectively the industry in terms of delivering housing supply dried up for a period of time, for several years actually. Leading into the great financial crisis, we were delivering about 1.5 million units of housing per year. Since the great financial crisis, over the last 15 years, we've delivered about 1 million housing units per year. So there's 500,000 unit shortfall of housing deliveries for a period of 15 years that effectively has led us into where we are today, which is, to your first question or second question, we're short about 3 to 4 million units of housing. Now you look around your cities where you live and you see, cranes and a lot of those cranes are building apartments, and there's concern that are we oversupplying apartments again? And what I would say to that is that we're still catching up from the lack of supply that was delivered over the past 15 years. And that lack of supply came at a time in context when we had the largest renter demographic, the millennial demographic, and now Gen Z entering into the ages of when they need apartments to rent. And the older, cohort of the millennials needing homes to buy, and those homes and apartments are not available. And that supply and demand imbalance is what's contributing to, home prices continuing to be elevated. I think if you look at, the Case-Shiller index, you'd probably see that home prices are still at an all-time high. There hasn't been a correction in the single family space. And apartment rental rates are near all-time highs as well, all because of the lack of supply and the excess demand that's out there. So yes, I would agree that, and even other national prognosticators, CBRE, the National Association of Realtors, they would all agree that there is a shortage of housing, despite the fact that there is a lot of supply getting delivered today. To go back to your first question, Jerry, I think the market, the investing market for multifamily, has looked at that supply and go back 18 months, 24 months from now, in addition to interest rates increasing, and that effectively increases the cost of capital, and therefore the decreases the returns on those real estates. Buyers effectively valued the real estate at a lower price. And when they valued the real estate at a lower price, they took rates into consideration and they took the supply pipeline into consideration, and in our estimation, overreacted. You mentioned Green Street had apartment values down 30%. That was as of the end of 2023. Today, they actually have apartment values down about 21 or 22% from peak. And there's a couple factors driving that. One of them being, candidly, that there was likely an overreaction to the supply that was coming into the apartment space relative to other commercial real estate sectors. And now that they're seeing that new supply is getting absorbed, they're adjusting values up. And we're seeing the same, in the bidding tents when we're participating in trying to acquire multifamily communities, that those values are now higher than we would have expected 6 months ago. And I think there's a couple important news events that have driven some of that. Back in April, you had Blackstone announce an acquisition of AIR Communities, which was a publicly traded apartment REIT. That was a $10 billion transaction. In May, you had Brookfield. Blackstone, by the way, is probably the largest real estate investment manager in the world. Brookfield's probably the second largest, or if not first. They announced a $1.5 billion acquisition of a portfolio of apartments from Starwood. And then just last month, KKR, again, another top five size real estate asset manager, announced the acquisition of a $2 billion portfolio of assets from Lennar, which is actually a home builder, but they have a multifamily arm, and they sold properties as well. And all three of those trades, they estimate, were around a 5% cap rate. And I think the market, quote unquote, believed cap rates to be in the high 5% range. These three massive trades, call it $15 billion of multifamily apartments, trading at a 5% cap rate, was positive news for the apartment world, and indicated that values are better than folks anticipated or expected, call it 6 months ago.
Well, that's excellent news if you're an apartment investor. And it part of it too, and I think I may ask this question, you know, maybe later in the show, but I wanted to go ahead and jump into it now. You've had a combination of, as you said, an overreaction to the supply. So everybody said, hey, well, you know, we're developing a million new units, not stopping to think, yeah, but how many renters are going to be in the pipeline, the demographics? You don't hear that story. You hear the story about, well, they oversupplied. Freak out. I'm like, wait a minute. There's 127 million Gen Zs and millennials coming into the stage where they're going to be renting apartments. So you can't look at only the, quote, supply and ignore the future demand. That's one issue. The second thing I think has been happening, I'd like your thoughts on this. It appears to me because rates skyrocketed so incredibly. I mean, this is the most aggressive rate hike cycle we've seen since 1980 with Paul Volcker, in terms of how quickly they raise rates, how abruptly. Then the other part of the issue, again, to me, appears to be that when you're trying to do valuations, it's kind of like I always tell my clients, okay, if your next door neighbor loses his job in a recession and his house is foreclosed on, it affects the comps everywhere. There's been, as I understand it, and again, I want your opinion on this, a dearth of sales. People are not willing to sell right now. The only people that are selling to establish a new floor on the market value are the people that are forced to sell, the distressed sellers. They got too far out on their skis. They probably did an adjustable rate mortgage on the deal. They bought at the top of the cycle when it's what the behavioral finance calls a winner's curse. You know, the last guy in the bid pays too much for it sometimes, especially at the top of the cycle. Do you see that also affecting these valuations? Because it looks to me like a lack of transactions is masking the real picture for the long run, and they don't take into account the demographics that much. And clearly Blackstone, KKR, and the other ones look at it a little bit differently.
Yeah, for sure. So if you go back to 2023 and even the first quarter of 2024, there were almost no transactions to be seen or heard of, indicating where values were. And up until December, I think we were all questioning, would the Fed continue their rate hike cycle? I believe it was in December when Chairman Powell said, we believe we're in pause mode now. Fast forward to today, and we think, well, maybe some cuts are in the near term. Over that period of time when there were no trades, you're exactly right. It's difficult to determine what the value of your property is if there isn't a next door neighbor or even somebody in the zip code selling their property. That's what we were living through. I think the validation of all of these major institutional trades, it was really the first strong signal that you know, there's safety in the water, if you will. I think you were kind of talking about, well, what's the distress scenario in multifamily and in apartments? And you're exactly right with respect to who's feeling distressed. The distressed sellers are those that bought probably in the middle of or late 2022 at the peak of values. They bought those properties with a business plan that you know they thought it'd come in there and maybe the project was a $50 million acquisition, and they were going to spend another $5 million renovating units and renovating the property. And by doing so, they would increase rents by X percent, and therefore have Y returns. They went into it thinking that, and then the rates hiked on them. They probably were borrowing floating rate debt and some sort of a bridge loan or maybe a bank loan, expecting to refinance that debt after they executed their value add program, and rates spiked on them. And now they're in a situation where they're feeling distressed. Most of those buyers bought properties that were in the lower quality segments and lower quality what I would call tertiary markets, meaning smaller markets with lower jobs, with low job growth, or even, you know, minuscule job support, very little retail support and entertainment support for those properties. And when the rates hike on you and they dry up your cash flows, you're having a conversation with your bank. That's where the distress is being felt today. And candidly, it's not that much volume relative to the entire size of the housing sector. You think about, there's, you know, 350 million people in the United States. There's, you know, there's probably 100 to 150 million housing units in the United States. You know, 99% of those people are, you know, they still have their jobs. They had decent wage growth. A lot of those people borrowed during the low rates environment, where they got mortgages at 3%. They're not selling their homes. They have no need to. They have no desire to. If I sell my home, I have to go get a new mortgage at 7% today. So there's very, very little distress. And just to bring it full circle back to your question, there were candidly very few trades to indicate where exactly values were up until probably the second quarter of this year.
All right, let's get to a little bit of a technical question. I know this is always, believe it or not, even though I'm a finance guy and I got my master's in financial planning and all that, bachelor's in economics, cap rates to me can kind of be a confusing issue. Let's go back to real estate 101, if you will. Explain to our radio audience, what are cap rates? How do they operate, and why are cap rates so affected by interest rates in the current cycle?
Great question. So the cap rate is a measurement. If I were to buy a property without any debt, the question is, relative to the price I paid, what are the cash flows that property would generate? So let's say, just simple math, it's a $10 million property, and we say it's a 5% cap rate. Well, that 5% cap rate effectively is 5% times $10 million or $500,000. That's the cash flow. The $500,000 is the cash flow that I expect to generate from that property, again, assuming that I have no debt on that property. And when we talk about cap rates, we're effectively talking about what's the valuation metric that a buyer is willing to pay, or that an asset would trade at, relative to its cash flows. So if you know, let's say that same $500,000 cash flowing property, has a bid on it for $9 million. Well, that cap rate is now a higher rate relative to the value of the asset. If that $10 million property instead has a bid of $11 million, the cap rate actually came down. So there's an inverse relationship between cap rate and value. If cap rates are coming down, values are going up. And if cap rates are going up, values are coming down. And that cap rate number, again, that's what you would expect the cash flow yield, we call it, to be generated by the property relative to the value or the price that was paid to for that property.
All right, so it's more or less kind of like yield on a stock, or if you have a CD at the bank, it's paying 3% or 4%, but it does move based on what the valuation of the property. So furthermore, explain now, all right, now the Fed raised rates from almost zero, and they shot through the roof. We were over 5 last time I checked. They haven't lowered rates yet. That has an outsized impact on assumptions, because again, we're going back to with all the real estate stuff that's out there, all the apartments that are out there, there's an assumption by the people that are doing the appraisals for the future based on, quote, cap rates. So they have certain expected cap rates they think is going to happen. So if rates shoot through the roof, then that has an outsized impact in the short run on the real estate valuations, not what you're going to sell it for necessarily, but what the appraisers think it's worth. Can you explain just a little bit about that and why it was so severe this cycle?
Yeah. So when the risk, what I call the risk-free rate, you know, the Fed funds rate increases, there's now a different alternative for me as a real estate investor. I need to consider, well, hey, the yield on a 10-year U.S. Treasury bond used to be 2%. Now it's, you know, 4.25. I can get 200 basis points better return on owning that 10-year U.S. Treasury bond than I could have 2 or 3 years ago. And now I need to consider, as I'm allocating investments for my portfolio, hey, this is a, you know, quote unquote risk-free rate, and it's pretty good. I should, you know, maybe consider this as an investment instead of real estate. And so that has a trickle effect into other asset classes like real estate that makes the buyer for real estate say, hey, I need to get a better return or else I'm not interested in investing in that type of an asset. And therefore, the cap rates are adjusting. And that's exactly what happened. And it isn't exactly a one for one, you know, the risk-free rate goes up by 10 basis points and therefore the cap rate goes up by 10 basis points. It's not perfect theory like that. But there is an impact, and that's what's happened. If I talk about, you know, the space that I'm familiar with in multifamily apartments, the cap rates got as low as 3.5% in early 2022. Well, today I mentioned when talking about those institutional trades, I mentioned the cap rates were closer to 5% today. That 150 basis point or 1.5% increase has a dramatic effect on the value of a property. As I previously mentioned, if cap rates are going up, well, guess what? Values are coming down. It's an inverse relationship there. So that's exactly what happened as the Fed started raising rates. And that's why when the Fed went on pause, that kind of settled the increases in cap rates and caused them to pause as well. And now you hear some chatter. It's mostly market chatter around, when will the Fed start to cut rates? Could it be as early as September, or maybe it's in December? You know, when will they cut rates? And the reason the market's talking about that and trying to speculate around that is that probably is the signal for when cap rates begin to decrease again. And if cap rates are coming down again, that means values are coming up again.
So maybe we're close to a bottom. So I did want to talk back to demographics a moment. We talked about demographics in our book, From Boom to Bust and Beyond, real extensively. We mentioned both the millennials and the Gen Zs, because again, I think there's been too much attention focused on the quote, short-term overbuilding, which is there, but at the same time, we're working, as you mentioned earlier, out of a huge deficit. There's a huge deficit. For 15 years, American builders and developers were not developing enough stuff. Now we've gone overboard. Seems like the pendulum of change always goes too far. But if you look at the millennials and the Gen Zs, look a little further out, let's say over the next decade or so, right now they're having a very difficult time trying to buy a single family home. So what happens again, all of us have lived through this, you know, you date, you get married, you have a baby. Usually the time you want a house is when you hear the first wah, you know, the baby's there and it's okay, it's time to get out of an apartment. But right now that's hard to do because as the surge in interest rates and home prices both up over 34% since the second quarter of 2020, according to Park Madison, the cost of owning a new home is 50% more expensive than renting. Do you want to elaborate on that? And in particular, what do you think the impact besides the short term, and there was, it drives me crazy that people drive down the road looking at the dashboard on the car. They don't look further down the road to see what's happening with this massive demographic boom that's coming. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Yeah, I'd love to. And let's not forget that these same millennials and Gen Zs that you're talking about are also getting married later in life. They have a higher proclivity for divorce. They're having children later in life, and all of these things effectively keep them in rentals for longer, which is good news for us as apartment owners. But specifically to your question, you know, home ownership is more expensive than renting today. And if you take yourself back to when you were, you know, 25, 30 years old, and you were debating, well, maybe we rent this single family residence, you know, we want to move out into a home, but maybe we should rent it instead of buy it. And what's the relative math there? What makes more sense? And, you know, when I was making that decision, I was going to Yahoo Finance and doing the rent versus buy calculator. And, you know, when I was looking at homes, it was telling me that buying was the right, you know, the right answer to that question. Today, almost across the board, it's going to say rent is the answer to that question. And the reason for that is the average apartment unit in the United States today is renting for about $1,800 a unit. You know, that's about 1,000 square feet. Maybe it has a bedroom or two. And that's, you know, $1,800 payment per month. It's very expensive relative to where it was. But guess what? If I go do that same math and check my calculator on buying a home today, the median priced home today is about $430,000. And mortgage rates are 7% plus. And if I do the math on that mortgage payment, and I include, you know, my insurance and my real estate taxes, forget about the maintenance of the home itself, it's going to come out to be about $3,000 a month. And so I'm comparing $3,000 a month to go buy a home or $1,800 a month to rent an apartment. It's very clear what the right answer is in terms of the value trade that I'm getting for renting versus owning. And so that's exactly what's happening. That's why when we see all these cranes building apartments, they're all getting leased up very quickly on record pace. We had a project just last year, maybe it was 2022, you know, 250 units or so. And we leased up that project in about 6 months. Typically, you would expect it to take 12 months, maybe 15 months to lease up a project. It was 6 months. And even this year, as we have properties that are in their lease-up period, we're still seeing a very normal 12-month lease-up period, despite the fact that there is a lot of supply, and that's because of the sheer size and demand coming from this demographic.
Makes sense. So again, you can't ignore the demand just by looking at the supply, which again is part of the problem. Now, despite the so with all that we've said, and we still know there's still new multifamily construction going on, and this is the lag effect. If you look at the new permits on developing multifamily, they've fallen off the cliff over the last 12 months. But same time, you still got stuff that's still in the pipeline coming on board. The last statistic I had is, in spite of that, apartment occupancy rates are still above 90%. I heard one guy say, you know, the goalposts, if you will, for apartment rentals are typically 92 is about the lowest. I remember, I think it got to 91.8 in the great financial crisis in 2008. 95% is the highest you want it, because if your occupancy is above 95, you're not charging enough in rent. What do you see about this? What's your comments on that?
Yeah. And I would tend to agree for the most part with those goalposts. That's exactly right. And, you know, market wide, we're seeing occupancies in the 94% to 95% range nationwide. Our portfolio is no different than that. We're right about at that national average, and I believe we will see occupancies continue to increase from here. Again, a lot of supply just entered the market. We're really in the eye of the storm with respect to that those supply deliveries, and as those supply deliveries get pulled back. And I don't think I mentioned why the supply deliveries are getting pulled back, because that's another economic phenomenon. But you just had all of these costs that increased due to the inflation. You now have borrowing rates for construction loans that used to be 3%. Borrowing rates for construction are now, let's call it 9% today. There are very few apartment projects that make economic sense to begin building today. And that's why you're seeing, if you look 12 months, 18 months, 24 months out from now, all the properties that should be delivered in those timeframes are properties that should be under construction today. They should have had a shovel in the ground 6 months ago, and they didn't because of this cost dynamic. So when we talk about, well, it's going to get better, we know it's going to get better, because it takes you 2 years to build that apartment project, and those projects didn't start. At least very few of them did start. And so you look at that and you say, well, there's going to be a lot of pressure on vacancy rates two years out from now to the better, meaning vacancy rates will come down, occupancy rates will come up, or perhaps we stay at that average, that sweet spot, you know, call it 94% occupancy, and we just drive rent growth more aggressively because there's, again, little supply getting delivered and that demand still is sitting there waiting for that supply.
So reality is it could be a good buy low, sell high possibility of new demand, new construction is falling off the map 2 years out. That's going to show up. And in the meantime, demographics are relentlessly marching on. I know we're on radio. I can't show a chart of the millennials and the Gen Z population, but it's a huge monster boom. We used to talk about the baby boomers as the quote pig and the python coming through society, and now the baby boomers are entering, you know, retirement. Now you got their kids, the millennials and Gen Z's, that are looking at family formation time, and this is an unprecedented situation after the great financial crisis, not building enough houses. So we've talked about the demographics for apartment demand look very strong over the next several years. Some developers got too far out over their skis. We know that's the problem. Now they're having to refinance. Do you think that there's going to be a lot more turmoil from these problem developers? Is that going to be a big deal, or is that really kind of a gnat on the, you know, on the dog in terms of the long-term outlook for apartments?
I would, if I had to pick a choice between those two, I would say it's probably more of a gnat on the dog at this point. If we were looking at inflation still raging, you know, 5% plus, if we were looking, you know, really no end in sight to the Fed rate hike cycle, I think I would have a different answer. But because we're now talking about potentially cutting rates, overall pretty strong economic environment today in terms of consumption and job growth. You know, we haven't seen massive distress in the employment. I think at this point in time, you're going to look back and say, wow, we would have expected it to be a lot worse for all developers, not just apartment developers, than it really was. And ultimately, most of them will get bailed out, so to speak, by us reversing back into a lower rate environment, or at least rate declines from where we are today.
That brings up kind of my final question is, it looks like if I'm looking at the publicly traded real estate stocks, most of them look like they've bottomed. So I think they're sensing that. If we assume, and I think to me, this is patently obvious, that rates have hit the top of their cycle. Let's say 18 months out, rates are half what they are now or less in terms of the Fed's control. It looks to me like we probably are bottoming out, have bottomed out, best guess, educated guess on the cycle. How soon do you think rent growth in terms of the what you charge for rent starts to accelerate back up again? Is that a 6 month, 18 month process? What's your guess?
My guess would be, you know, today we're basically flat. You know, this summer I would say we're, you know, slightly better than budget, slightly better than what we expected for 2024, but not anywhere near the levels of rent growth we saw in 2021 and 2022, which were double digit rent growth years. I think you'll see probably 12 more months of kind of flat to slightly positive rent growth. And then from there on out, it should be pretty smooth sailing, you know, growing rents at least, you know, 2 to 3%, which is sort of our base case in our models. And I think, you know, very common for most real estate and apartment buyers, and slightly better than 3% perhaps for those years when we're just not delivering units because they didn't start construction in 2024.
Okay. So potential shortage coming up down the road, not right away. Got to absorb the current bulge of oversupply. It's going to be interesting to see where exactly those apartments are and how that affects, because everything, as we know, the old saying, real estate is local. All real estate's local.
Yes.
But anyway, so I really appreciate, Adam, your comments on this. Been very insightful. I think what we need to do is just, again, this drives me crazy. I said this in our book, From Boom to Bust and Beyond. Wall Street in particular, and most investment analysts, they're examining the bark on the tree when the forest fires come in raging over the hill. They don't seem to see the long term. They look at everything in the short run, and the media reinforces that. I think we got to step back sometimes and take a longer term view. And again, to me, the demographics are relentlessly positive for the next 5 to 10 years. And I don't think apartments are going away. So thank you for your time. We'll appreciate it. We'll maybe have you back in again next 6 months or so.
Would love to.
Jerry Tuma's Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone could help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA, SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.